obviously, has motivated the search for alternative, non-perturbative ways of quantizing. Now, of course, one question is, I mean, what do we mean by non-perturbative quantization? So very generally, and somewhat loosely speaking, by that I mean a quantization where, in principle, you are including configurations, quantum configurations, that might be very far from any classical, in this case, smooth solution. So that's, of course, a very loose definition, but it's difficult kind of to nail this down more precisely. But of course, we'll see explicit examples later on. OK, I put far. Of course, far has to be specified in some way. Far from any classical solutions. OK, of course, that immediately raises the question, well, what do we mean by quantizing in such a context? And of course, I'm phrasing the question this way. Of course, well, you could say that's maybe not the right way of thinking about it physically. You know, if our theories are just per se and inherently a quantum, well, somehow I should start just from the quantum theory and then maybe check that it has a good classical limit. But of course, in practice, we are very much, well, we have to, our start, we have one well-defined starting point often, and that's certainly in gravity, that is the classical theory. So we need to think about it as a quantization, a procedure. It's not altogether kind of illogical. OK, now we started looking at what this might mean in a phase space formulation of gravity. And I'm going to say a few more things today generally about Hamiltonian dynamics in the presence of gauge symmetry before we are going to move on to the more specific case of gravity as a particular example of that. So let me just start by being slightly formal and put a definition on the board which ties in with what we said yesterday. So I was talking about phase spaces. So phase spaces are really kind of differentiable manifolds with an additional structure on them. So you can very much think of them in analogy with metric spaces, right? First of all, of course, you're given some manifold. You have no specific structure apart from the differentiable structure on it. And then and you don't know how to measure distances. But once I've given you a metric structure, you're able to do measurements of angles, to make measurements of angles and distances. Now, the same thing applies here. You know, I give you kind of a naked manifold. And then I add a particular other structure, which is the symplectic structure. And that enables you also to do certain things. So it's actually a symplectic structure. It's very quite analogous to, you know, kind of that of a metric. But it's not that per se exists. It's something you're adding. So, and that, of course, gave rise to the Poisson brackets. So let me just slightly more formally define what this is. So a symplectic manifold, AKA a phase space, is a pair S omega, or maybe I should call it M. So where S is a differentiable manifold and omega, and omega is a closed two form. Okay, so that's very much a kind of differential geometer's way of putting it. Now, what was that again? A two form. In differential geometry, you can define kind of forms, and inexplicitly, so they are just tensors of a certain rank. And their specific feature is that they're totally anti-symmetric. So they are covariant tensors with, in a specific coordinate system, a number of indices, and they're totally anti-symmetric with respect to interchange kind of the individual kind of entries. So this is nothing but then an anti-symmetric covariant two tensor. And what means closed? Well, closed for a form means its exterior derivative vanishes. Now, why this has to be so for a symplectic structure, let me not go into. So a closed, oops, I forgot something. A non-degenerate true form. So the non-degeneracy is very analogous to what you would have for a matrix. You say it has no zero eigenvalues. And here, of course, this omega, so it's a covariant two form. So it's an object like a matrix, if you like, which has two slots in which you can insert vectors to get a number out at a specific, at a given point, right? So let me just write down kind of how this works. So you just pick a point P. So, and what does your symplectic form do at this point? Well, you can think of it as a map from the tangent vectors for a pair of tangent vectors into the reals. So I hope you're familiar with that notation. So that's a tangent space 2. So it's a phase space S at a point P. And of course, an element of that is just a vector. So this goes at a point P from pairs of vectors to real numbers, as I was saying. So explicitly, you just give me a pair of vectors. And my symplectic form makes a number from this, a real number. So that's very similar to what you would have for a metric G, right? At a point P, that would go from TPM. So I call now the manifold M, TPM, also to the reals. And of course, what is this? Again, you can think of that as a kind of a slot, a kind of an object with two slots, so a machine that takes two vectors, again, xp and yp, and produces a number, which of course in that case is simply the scalar product of x and y at p. So think in terms of this analogy. Now, how does this tie in with the definition in terms of Poisson brackets we had yesterday? So Poisson brackets defining kind of a certain algebraic structure on the face of all functions on S. Now, here we are talking about vectors, or of course, if I leave out this P, I have entire vector fields. So I can think of omega as acting on pairs of vector fields and producing a function. So the relation with the Poisson brackets is as follows. these were just two functions on S. Now that's the same as looking at the symplectic form and putting here in as the vector fields. The vector fields are introduced yesterday that are naturally associated with functions, the so-called Hamiltonian vector fields, if you remember. So Hamiltonian vector fields. And that's the same. So it's actually the same as having kind of the vector field act on the corresponding to F, act on the function G. And because of the antisymmetry of both of these things, of course, it's actually the same as having the vector field G act on the function F. So also here one is really using kind of the this dual interpretation of vectors as derivatives on functions, right? Because a vector just defines for me a direction on my manifold. And of course, taking the derivative is just looking at the change of the function in the direction in which that vector is pointing, right? So please remember how these things go. So in particular example would be if now here for the Hamiltonian vector fields, just to make this slightly more explicit, so if my function, say, f or g alternatively, happens to be one of my coordinate functions, so I'm really sitting on a phase space now that is R2n, then xqi, just using the definition I put yesterday, is kind of the vector field in the conjugate, in the direction of the coordinate conjugate to qi. Right. And similarly, if you look at the special case that the function is the momentum function pi, then this is in the partial differential with a minus sign now in the direction kind of conjugate of the conjugate coordinate of pi, which is qi. So this is just kind of apropos of the Hamiltonian vector fields that will keep coming up in what follows. OK, now this discussion now, I said, now how does gauge symmetry appear in this context? And that goes now under a new heading, that of constrained Hamiltonian systems. So this word constraint that's appearing here, that relates actually to how the presence of gauge symmetry kind of plays out now at a at this Hamiltonian level. Now I left myself a little space here, so let me rather go to this blackboard. So what are constraints? Constraints are just equations, algebraic equations, that define subspaces of your phase space from you. Now, where do these constraints come from? Let me explain in a few lines. So one starts out with a Lagrangian system, on which one applies a Legendre transformation, which already kind of is a gauge system. And we call this now in a finite dimensional context, we call that a singular Lagrangian system. And I define what I mean by this. And it will lead us exactly to the type of systems you want to consider when we talk about gauge symmetry. So that we look at an n-dimensional, so we're talking still about mechanics, Lagrangian system. I call this singular if, now, the determinant of a certain quadratic matrix, omega ij, which I define now, vanishes. So what is omega ij? It's the matrix of second derivatives with respect to the velocities of your Lagrangian system. So you have a bunch of these qi's, which are just the coordinates of your Lagrangian system. Let's just imagine we are in a sufficiently simple system where these exist globally. And this is kind of the Hessian. And well, here we are looking at a condition that the determinant of this should vanish. Now, this is very reminiscent of our quantum field theoretic analysis, if you recall, which I did for gravity, showing that if I now write, kind of rewrite kind of the derivative term, so the quadratic term of my Lagrangian density in a form, say, phi, del mu phi mu, some differential operator, del mu, phi mu operator phi mu, and if I do this for gravity, analogously for the linearized fields, then for gauge systems, I will meet this peculiar property that this will be this thing in between the two fields will not be invertible. And that's exactly the same condition here at the level of a finite dimensional Lagrangian system. So this is exactly analogous condition here, I'd like to point out. So what follows, so this was an n-dimensional system. Now, if it so happens, so of course this is a matrix, and this has a rank, this matrix, right? And the lower the rank, the higher the degeneracy. So if the rank of W is M, which by definition for the singular system must be then smaller than its dimension N, then we have N minus M zero eigenvectors for this matrix. So let me call them Y with kind of, this is just a label running from A, running from the 1 to M. So this is the equation for zero eigenvector. So I've contracted one of the indices. Is there a problem there? Excuse me, is there a problem here? Is there a problem? So these are the eigenvectors, these y's, y running from, so a running from 1 to m. Now the immediate consequence, it says, if I now perform a Legendre, or attempt a Legendre transformation of the singular system, is the following. So the Legendre transformation does, as usual, go from kind of the pairs, qi, coordinates, and velocities to a bunch of coordinates and conjugate momenta. Now, this is actually also singular. If you think of it as a kind of a coordinate transformation. Now, why is that? So it's very easy to see, going back to this matrix Wij. So let me write the determinant as this kind of modulus sign. Now, this, of course, this is just, here I'm just copying the definition of Wij. But of course, you can see dL by dQj dot is just, by definition, the conjugate momentum, Qj, the conjugate momentum, Pj. So this is actually kind of the Jacobian of dPj. Transformation from the Q dots to the piece, right? And by definition, this vanishes. So this was not a good one-to-one coordinate transformation. So actually, what it turns out to be, this is only a map onto a subspace of all the phase space. So this is how this is degenerate. I mean, this is just usual kind of differential geometry. So let me continue here. So it's actually impossible to kind of solve for all of my qi dots. So I cannot write them all as functions kind of these new coordinates q and p. Or yet another way of phrasing it is we have so not all momenta are independent, but we have M relations on phase space. So M relations phi alpha q p equal to 0. So A, sorry, where A runs from 1 to m. So that's, again, that's the same number of kind of degenerate directions or singular directions of this original Hessian for my Lagrangian system. And these are called now constraints. The constraints of my system, Hamiltonian constraints. And for all what follows, I mean, there are many, many different kind of types of constraints, but I'll be assuming in everything that follows, and that's also the case relevant for us and for gravity, that these constraints are independent. So assumed independent. And so what immediately follows is that when they constrain me to a submanifold of my original phase space, which is of dimension 2n minus m. So of course, for each of these, I subtract one dimension. I'll get to you in a sec. So this defines a 2n minus m dimensional so-called constrained surface. It's a constrained surface. So the surface defined by these constraints. And the notation I will use is S, curly S, index C. So that's the subspace of the adjoint phase. Yes, question.
Vectors, and then you label them from 1 to m. So should that be from 1 to n minus m, or should there only be m0?
I have m0 eigenvectors. The rank, hang on. No. Okay. The rank, well, these are the good directions. So, yes. Yeah, but I do want to use m here. So the rank, so where, no, I should put, so the rank is n minus m. Minus m, no, that's right. Yes, thank you. Okay, now, if this seems all a little abstract, let me give you a very simple, explicit example to see how this plays out. My example has absolutely no physical relevance. It's just a cooked up example of a Lagrangian to kind of exercise through what these definitions imply. So my Lagrangian, so the system lives on R3 with three coordinates Q1, Q2, Q3, and Lagrangian like this, one kinetic standard kinetic term for Q1, plus C, some constant, Q2 dot Q1, minus m half Q1 squared plus Q2 squared plus Q3 squared. So n is 3. Okay, so let me, so Q1 kind of has a standard kind of harmonic oscillator piece associated with it. Q2 appears only linear in the velocities, and for Q3, no velocity at all appears. Okay, so let us have a look at the conjugate momenta, canonically conjugate momenta. So P1 is dl by dQ1 dot, which is just Q1 dot. So that's fairly standard. P2 is given by dl by dQ2 dot, which gives me here a C times Q1. And P3, well, there is no Q3 dot, so this is just 0. Now, my Wij, right, here I have to look at the piece quadratic in velocities, and only this here contributes, right? So my Wij is this, okay? Because only in the one direction are things kind of regular. And I have, obviously, I have 2 0 eigenvectors. Now, my claim here was that if I have m 0 eigenvectors, I'll find m relations. And of course, they're already standing here. So phi1, it's just this relation here with everything brought to the left-hand side. So phi1 of QP is this relation, P2 minus CQ1. And of course, yeah, so this should be 0. And the second relation is even simpler. It's just this, P3, which should vanish. So these are my two constraint equations. And you see, of course, we would have expected regularly a six-dimensional phase space. But we've ended up on a sub-manifold offset, which is only four-dimensional, because these two constraints have to be satisfied by the momenta and coordinates. Right? So the constraint surface is four-dimensional in this case. So that was an explanation of how constraints arise, right? When I start from a Lagrangian, that is pathological because, well, this Hessian matrix is degenerate. And of course, we already know from our field theoretic considerations that this is intimately connected with having gauge symmetry around. Now, we'll be confining ourselves to specific types of constrained Hamiltonian systems. And according to a classification that was made first by Dirac, we call them systems of first-class constraints. And those are the ones that will be relevant. And those are the ones that are really related with the presence of local, like in the quantum field theory, of local gauge symmetry. Okay, so let me just write down the definition of that. So a Hamiltonian system with M constraints of the type I've just derived for you, functions phi A of QP that are required to vanish, is called first class. First class. If two conditions are satisfied. So firstly, the Poisson brackets of two constraints must again be writable as a linear combination of the constraints. So it has to be equal to FAB. C, phi, C. So some linear combination that may depend, well, so will depend on these, on the indices, constraint indices. So these are Poisson brackets. And secondly, phi A Poisson brackets with the Hamiltonian H, which I should really have mentioned here up in my definition, also is a linear combination of constraints. Now, there is nothing here that says these Fs or Ds should be constants at all. OK, so if they were constants, that would define kind of the algebra relations. But there is nothing here in this definition that requires them to be a constant. One piece of notation I should introduce, which is very much used. Now I've erased my picture of the kind of this being S, kind of this being the constraint surface SC, is a kind of equality on the constraint surface. So already we understand kind of the relevant arena for the Hamiltonian dynamics of these constraint systems is just this constraint surface. So what happens off this surface is really of little relevance to us in systems that can be consistently defined, and this is really equivalent with systems that obey these two conditions. So there's a special notation one introduces for, so this is a piece of notation, which we'll also be using, wiggly equality signs. Oops. So means equality on the constraint surface. And actually, in finite dimensions, what you can show what this always means, it means equality up to a linear combination of the constraints. Yeah. Because you can show that anything that vanishes on the constraint surface by necessity has to be a linear combination of these constraints. Okay, that as an aside. Okay, so for example, this I could write then here equivalently as, this is also called weak vanishing. This I can write as Poisson brackets of constraints A and B weakly vanish. So this is just applying this. And similarly for the second relation there. So yeah, I'll make now a somewhat nice. This is the picture here. So let me make a slightly nicer picture than I just said here. And let us kind of look at the implications of these algebraic relations. So first I have, so this, let this be my big S schematically, so this box. So this is my S, but I already know that kind of all the interesting dynamics happens on this SC. So this here had dimension 2n, this four-phase space, and this now has dimension 2n minus m. Because I assumed the constraints are all independent, so for each of one I can really kind of subtract a dimension. Now, so the first implication, of course, of the presence of these constraints is that I'm confined to the submanifold. And let us have a look at some other implications. In particular, now, what does this setup now have to do with gauge symmetry? Where do I see unphysical gauge degrees of freedom coming in now in the Hamiltonian population? OK, so the first thing to note is actually that by virtue of coming from this singular Lagrangian system, the Hamiltonian is actually not unique. You can actually write down an infinite set of Hamiltonians that all coincide on this constrained surface. And there is no way to start with to say any one of those is better than any other one. So we have a whole collection of Hamiltonians that seem on the face of things kind of equivalent because they coincide on the constraint surface, and they all differ by linear combinations of the constraints. Phi m q p, where I feel now indicated that really this may depend arbitrarily on the phase space coordinates, these coefficients cm. Now, so clearly, well, this vanishes on the constrained surface. So, well, they just coincide as functions. But of course, they still contribute to equations of motion, kind of these terms here. And that can be very easily seen. So if I look just at the time evolution, of some phase space function. Let me call it little g. Then the time evolution is just given by Poisson brackets with my Hamiltonian. So this H is kind of my the reference Hamiltonian of my system, if you like, and fix this. But I, as I said, I can arbitrarily add these functions. So I get two terms. Right? This is, of course, like kind of a derivative. So I get a term where, as a Poisson bracket, kind of sees the coefficient, and another one where it sees the it's distributive, it sees the constraint. So these are the terms I get, g, c, m. Now, I'm interested, of course, only in stuff that happens on the constrained surface. Now, clearly, this vanishes on the constrained surface. So it's weakly equal to zero. But this here, in general, doesn't vanish. Right? So this gives a non-trivial contribution, seemingly, to the equations of motion. And what we see here, kind of rather bizarrely, is that, well, seemingly, my dynamics seems to depend on m arbitrary phase space functions. Right? So, and of course, well, that cannot make sense. Right? So the dynamics has to be uniquely defined. So the way to set things up, and that is kind of inherent in requiring these conditions to be satisfied, is really how to come up now with a well-defined dynamics where you can explicitly see that these functions don't play any role dynamically. And as a matter of fact, well, one of the things you can do is just to, again, gauge fix kind of these coefficients. So that's one way of looking at it, kind of in analogy with what we did in the path integral. So so the equations of motion, of course, in particular, those for Q and P, are now ambiguous, or seemingly, right? Because you can just write Qi dot on the constrained surface dH by dPi plus these functions Cm, so phi m pi pi dot is equal to, on the constrained surface, partial derivative, Qi minus Cm del phi m by del Qi. Okay, sorry for squeezing this in down there. So seemingly, my equations of motion now contain m arbitrary phase space functions. Now, in order to make a consistent system of this, we have to require that the constraints are preserved under time evolution. So what I mean by this is the following condition. So let me write this down. Again, substituting in this Hamiltonian with the arbitrary functions in there, Cn, for the particular case that I'm looking at now, the constraint itself, now, if this is the case, then I won't get kind of contributions to my equations of motion when I move along the flow lines. Well, there are two ways of reading it. But if I move along kind of the flow lines of the Hamiltonian, then the contribution I get from these phis, of course, kind of stays constant. Just to say that this is actually just reading off from my definition over there. This is, of course, satisfied by both of my assumptions here, namely the assumptions were that the constraints are in involution, so they kind of they close on themselves on the constraint surface, and that the dynamics, this H, leaves them invariant. Now, let me zoom in on the equation phi m with H being weakly equal to 0. So there are two ways of reading it, which I kind of just started to explain. But let me do it in a slightly more organized way. So this is needed for consistency. Now, in the relation I wrote down earlier, which gave you kind of Hamiltonian vector fields associated to functions that appear in Poisson brackets, there were kind of two ways of reading it. Okay, this has a kind of Poisson bracket with phi, has an associated Hamiltonian vector field, and so has taking a Poisson bracket with H, which has also an associated vector field, which is distinguished because it's exactly kind of the vector field where the time evolution, well, which points in the direction of the time evolution. So when you're solving the system, of course, that is kind of the flow you're following. So that really defines the dynamics of the system. Now, now I should get this right myself. So the first way of interpreting this is kind of looking at what it means if I now look at the Hamiltonian vector field associated with the evolution. So what does this condition imply? It implies XH applied on these constraints, on the constraint surface, vanishes. So the constraints do not change under evolution, right? So so in other words, whatever this flow does, it doesn't take me away from this constrained surface. Because if it did, then the value of these phis would change away from zero. Right? So the flow, the evolution, happens in the surface. So that's kind of obvious that this is needed for consistency of this entire dynamical system. So that means here, flow of the Hamiltonian stays on this constraint surface. But secondly, I can read it in another way. I can read it also that in the way that, well, the Hamiltonian remains unchanged when I'm on the constraint surface when I move along the vector field associated with the constraints. So in other words, kind of physics doesn't actually change when I move along the flow lines defined by the Hamiltonian vector fields associated with the constraints. So that's this dual way of looking at things. So it's rather clever. H is unchanged when moving in the direction of the vector fields, the Hamiltonian vector fields associated with these constraints. So x phi a h equals 0. So let me just, for wrapping up, maybe just make one a little sketch with a simple example to see what's going on again. And you look at a similarly simple example in the exercises this afternoon. So so these x phi's, they correspond to gauge directions. Now, how to see this? So let me take an example, a very simple example, where similar but even easier than the one I had on the board earlier, let there be a single constraint phi, let this be equal to p3. So the vanishing of the third momentum, say in my six-dimensional phase space I had earlier, confines me to a submanifold. To a submanifold of dimension 5. So this was again my S, say dimension 6. Now, here is my constraint surface defined by the vanishing of P3. Now, on the constraint surface, I now want to look at this Hamiltonian vector field, right? And just by definition, xp3, I had it on the board earlier for the general case, is simply kind of the partial derivative in the q3 direction. So let this be, so this is kind of blue. So let me indicate on the constraint surface, kind of, this is the direction of this xp3. And you see what we are now saying is that, well, this on the constraint surface, if I now integrate up the flow lines of this, I get one-dimensional orbits. And these are, of course, again, these are gauge orbits, because this direction of Q3 has now been identified with a direction in which physics doesn't change, in which the Hamiltonian remains invariant. Right? So what I can introduce again, in complete analogy with what we did in the path integral, I can introduce an additional condition on the constraint surface itself, a gauge condition, which cuts in each of these gauge orbits once. And so the equivalence, the set of equivalence classes under kind of the gauge transformation induced associated with this vector field gives me what is called the physical phase space. The physical phase space. And it is kind of the constraint surface divided by kind of taking the equivalence relation with respect to this gauge action. So in our case, of course, this would be the space R4, where we've thrown away the coordinates P3, because that was my original constraint, if you like, but also Q3 effectively is irrelevant for the dynamics. So we end up kind of with an induced, kind of reduced phase space of two variable pairs, Q1, P1, Q2, P2. And I can get this in various ways, but it's clear what one has to do here is, again, gauge fix or divide out by gauge equivalence or some such thing. Okay, so now you have an idea of how this all works in the Hamiltonian formalism. And I see you again tomorrow, if not earlier.